because, you know, the student was ready that day for my car. And Keith and I have met up several times since then. When I found out he was coming here, I hopped a plane from Alabama. I don't know who the other people from Alabama are, but welcome. I'm also from Alabama. But Keith, if you haven't heard him do his 12 steps, I hope you get as much out of it as I do. And please welcome Keith Lewis.
Thank you, Vicki. My name is Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic. Just delighted to be here. There are a lot of people here for a Saturday afternoon, and I was telling Stacy what that means is football season's over. That's what that means. Let's be honest about this thing. You know, if the Bulldogs were playing, this room would be half full. And that's just the way it is. I really am delighted to be here. I have quite a history in Georgia, and a good history. I mean, there are states I can't say that about, but I have a great history in Georgia, and it's always a pleasure to be here. I want to thank the committee for inviting me, and I want to thank the other speakers for their efforts. This is for fun and for love. That's why we do this stuff. And I drove down with Mike W., last night's speaker, and I've known Mike for 26 years. And I don't think we ought to get paid for this, but we ought to get paid for having to spend that much time in a car with Mike W. No, we had a great time. We really did. We had a ball. I want to say hi to a friend of mine who can't be here today, and her name's Maggie. And I just love Maggie a lot. She had a fall, unfortunately, and was unable to come. And I just want to say hello to her. I have known Maggie a long time, though I only met her fairly recently. I had a friend, a dear, dear friend of mine. His name was Bob Brown. Bob got sober in a Biscayne room, and when he was fairly newly sober, he came to Washington, D.C., and became one of my dearest friends. And Mike, last night's speaker, was his sponsor. And Mike spent the last 3 years of his life essentially bedridden, but still very active. And Alcoholics Anonymous, he would hear fifth steps and things like that. And whenever I had a pigeon who was whining, I would pick him up and drive him to Bob's house on Wednesday night. And Bob would take the oxygen out and prop himself up in his bed and shake the guy's hand and say something like, "Isn't it wonderful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous?" And if they whined after that, I just fired them. The hell with it. Mike and I got to spend time with Bob during his last hours. And one of the things that Bob said to me was, we're talking about things we wish we had done and things we wish we hadn't done and all of that. And Bob said, the one thing I wish I could do is to thank Maggie. He said, I never sufficiently thank Maggie for saving my life. And earlier this year, I was over in Coleman, Alabama, at Father Hillary's place doing a retreat. And for Bob, I got to thank Maggie. I'm always kind of dubious about talking about the 12 steps. One of the things that I think's happened in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's not that I'm an old timer, I'm really not, I'm pretty new, but I just look old. But one of the things that's happened, and it seems to have happened in Alcoholics Anonymous the last so many years, is a lot of talking. It's like talk therapy. It's like if I've talked about something, I've done everything I can do about it. And of course, that's not so. I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous is based upon something that was called moral psychology. And what moral psychology is looking at what's wrong and then taking actions to correct it. And that's what the 12 steps are about. It's about finding what's wrong and taking actions that correct what's wrong. I got a call from a fellow. I'd just gotten back from California. I was out in California the last 3 weekends, and I'd gotten back Monday night, and it was a number of calls on the machine, but one of them was a guy I figured I better call right away, and I called him, and he was having a little bit of trouble. I'd never met him. He lived in another state. And I talked to him, and it occurred to me that he had it figured out. He had spent a lot of time thinking about what the problem was, and he had it all figured out. But I said to him, "What have you done?" He said, "Well, I've been thinking about it." And I said, "Great. You know, I said, your insight is just amazing. I said, I'm really impressed with your insight. I said, I don't think that I've found someone with as thorough an insight as you since the last bar I was in." I mean, because that's really what we did in a bar, wasn't it? We would beat something 30 ways to Sunday and come up with all these answers. And the problem was they never fit the problem. And we never took any action. And if we don't take action, then we die. I'm reminded of the four women. This is not going to be a sexist joke. But four women were playing golf, and one sliced a tee shot over in the next fairway, and she hollered four, but it was too late. And she looked over, and there was this man rolling around on the floor, and he had his hands between his legs, just in misery. He's rolling around on the ground, and she ran over, and she said, "Sir, I'm so sorry." Well, he couldn't even respond. He was in terrible pain, had his hands between his legs, just rolling around. And she said, "Sir, I'm a physical therapist. I believe I can help you." And she unbuckled his pants and unzipped his pants, and she began to massage him. And she said, "Dare, doesn't that feel better?" He said, "Yes, it does, but my thumb still hurts like hell." So the moral of the story is hang around a golf course. No, that isn't the moral. The moral of the story is there are a lot of good solutions that just don't fit the problem. And I mean, they're wonderful solutions. I don't think there's a guy in here who wouldn't agree that's a great solution. But maybe some of the girls would. I don't know. But the problem is that the solution doesn't fit the problem. And that's what these steps are designed to do. These steps are designed to fit the specific and unique problems, not to us as individuals, but to us as alcoholics. And they are basic spiritual principles. They certainly are. They're based upon thousands of years of the very best moral thought. And that's the basis of what we do. It's not based on psychology, although there's certainly psychological aspects, and it isn't based on religion, although the roots are certainly religious. What it is it's sound spiritual principles. And I think it's a belief. It's a fundamental belief that if I do the right thing, good stuff happens. If I do the wrong thing, bad stuff happens. And it's really that simple. I really believe it is. And it's also based on the premise that none of this is to make me feel better. Now, I love feeling good. I mean, that's why I drank. The book tells me that that's the principal reason that I drank. It was because of the way it made me feel. I remember my poor ex-wife said to me one time with tears, you know, the mascara, she used to put it on heavy on crying days because, you know, and the mascara would be running down her face and look like something out of a horror flick, you know. And she'd say to me, "Why do you drink? You make my life miserable. Why do you drink?" And in all candor, I was able to say to her, "Why don't you?" If I felt that bad, I'd drink. Well, I don't feel that bad and I drink. Why don't you drink? And what I didn't know was that what happened to her wasn't what happened to me. It didn't make her feel better. I mean, there was a point at which it made her feel worse. I couldn't imagine such a thing. But I remember one time she was going to show me how disgusting I was. And she said, "Tonight I'm drinking like you drink. I want to show you how disgusting you are." And so we went off to the party, and she drank sort of like I drank. I mean, about half as much, but like it. And by 10 o'clock, she was sick and drunk. And I put her in the car, and all the way home, she's thrown up. And I put her in bed, and she said, "Honey, the room's spinning. So I said, "Well, put one foot on the floor. I just hate dealing with these amateurs." And the next morning, I got up and went running, which I did every morning. And all I heard, there was a pile of blankets over there, and all I heard was, "Oh, if you loved me, you'd kill me." You know. And so when I got back from my run, I'd taken a shower, and I was looking all perky and pink. And I said to her, you know, she'd finally gotten up and gotten some orange juice down or something. She looked just terrible. And I said to her, "Honey," I said, "you know, I don't mean to pry or anything, but perhaps you shouldn't drink, and sort of ended the experiment in our house. But I didn't know that she couldn't do with this stuff what I was doing with it, and I didn't know that it wasn't doing for her what it did for me. I was always mystified why people who were miserable didn't drink a lot. And it wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and began to understand a little bit about this illness that I discovered that they don't drink like I drank because they can't drink like I drank. Now, everything has a price. And the price for me was the moment I took my first drink was I stopped growing up. And I took it young. And I came to you emotionally very, very young and very childlike, as a matter of fact. And so that's the price I paid. The other price I paid was from the day I began to drink. I drank for 12 years, and I could go back over those 12 years, and I could document how each year I was less the man I wanted to be than I'd been the year before. Each and every year, my emotional and moral life deteriorated. Even when it looked like I was doing well, my life deteriorated. If you're kind of new, and I met someone who's kind of new, and I'm delighted that you're here. 60 days is a long time without drinking. It's a lot of not drinking, 60 days. And I applaud your being here. I could never have been here with 60 days. I've been hanging from the ceiling 60 days. But no matter what anybody says, this whole deal really is about building character. It really is. You don't hear it much anymore, but when I came in, they used to always say things like, the old man will drink again. And that's true. If I don't change, I'll drink again. It isn't about getting happy. It really isn't. Sometimes I'm happy, sometimes I'm not happy. What it's about is joy. And I can be unhappy and filled with joy. It's not about feeling good. Sometimes I feel good, sometimes I don't feel good. It's about spiritual growth. It's about being a better man this time this year than I was this time last year. And that's what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are designed to do. If I'm not morally more fit now than I was this time last year, then I'm just plain not doing it right. And I know there are people sitting out there saying, he means no sex. And that's not what I'm saying. I may have had a little less sex this time this year than I did this time last year. It's got nothing to do with the program, I can assure you. The great fear, of course, in Alcoholics Anonymous is I won't get to do what I want to do. I mean, it's really what it's all about. They don't want me to have any fun. I'm never going to have any fun again. Think about where you've been and tell me how much fun you've been having. You know, the 12 steps are a set of principles. And the first principle is we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Somebody told me they had a book and they were going to check me. Is that right? Okay, thanks. I just appreciate it. Going to stand up and embarrass me, number one. And number two, he's going to call my sponsor. So. But that's the first step. And we make a big deal out of the first step in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think we should, because that's really the first great decision that you ever make is that one. Powerless over alcohol, our lives have become unmanageable. What that basically means to me is that I will drink again. That's what it means to me. The way I envision the first step is there's a drink ahead of me. Okay? Now, I know the drink that's behind me. The drink that's behind me, I took somewhere in the middle of a blackout, in the middle of the night, May 13th, 1973. Okay, that's the drink. And that's an important date in my life. Next month I'll celebrate 27 years in this marvelous program. It's an important date to the people who love me. My lovely wife, Julia, does cross-stitch, and she cross-stitched that date on everything. Bookmarkers, everything, seat covers. If you sit in our house, she'll stitch that on you. I mean, that's a big day in our life. But that's not the drink that's important to me. Okay, that's not the drink that's important. The last drink I took was never important to me as an alcoholic. What's important to me is what Mike talked about last night, and it talks about in the doctor's opinion. And that's the next drink I'll take. Because what I know about being an alcoholic is this: I must drink again. Now, I want to tell you, that sets alarms off in me. As my old sponsor, Sandy, used to say, that's an emergency. Unless there's a miracle. And that's where you come in. You're the miracle. Okay. Mike was talking to me on the way down. Boy, was he talking to me on the way down. But one of the things he said that I heard, besides, can we stop at Dunkin' Donuts? One of the things that he said was, you know, the miracle, we're talking about the miracle. And he said, you know, the miracle isn't that I haven't had a drink in 30 years. You'll have 30 years in July. He said, that's not the miracle. He said, the miracle is that I stopped. And that's the miracle. Why that day? You know, why that day in the radio station that we stopped? And that's the miracle. The great miracle is that we stopped. And we have a friend, Ross M., delightful man, and Ross says that the miracle happened in 1935, and my only decision is whether or not I want to take part in it. And I know that's true. I know that there's a drink out ahead of me that I must take, and I tried many, many ways to not take the next drink. I worked in a teaching hospital, and one of the things they do in a teaching hospital is they list the causes of death. They do a number of autopsies. So they'll list who they're going to post and what they died of. And I'd watch this list. And if they had, sometimes they'd have an old guy there, like maybe 40, who died a chronic alcoholic, you know. And I'd go down and scrub into the autopsy and watch. And I'd look at the liver and the brain and, you know, oh, God. And I'd, you know, I'd take it as long as I could, and I'd run out of there, and I'd go to Clyde's or Chadwick's or someplace, and I'd run into Chadwick's and say, Vinny, you better give me a double. You'll never guess what I just saw. And he said, you always get a double. I said, well, you better make it a triple. And he'd give me a triple martini. And I'd my hand shaking and everything. And everybody's sitting at the bar, and they'd say, what's the matter? And I said, God, I just saw an autopsy. You'll never guess. It's awful. This man's brain was about two-thirds of the size it should have been, and had all these broken blood vessels in it and his liver. And I'm going on and on and describing all of this stuff. The guys would say to Vinny, God, you better give us a triple, too. I mean, you know, and then we'd discuss how this person must not have had a decent self-image and all of that stuff. And I didn't know about the child within, but I bet he was in there, too. And so clearly what I was trying to do was I was trying to frighten myself into not taking that next drink. And, of course, it couldn't work. It never worked. That's why I'm an alcoholic. And so what's important to me is the drink that's out ahead of me. Now, when I first got sober, the drink was 5 minutes ahead of me. It was 5 minutes ahead of me. I could almost taste it. There were days I could taste it. I could smell it. It was just out ahead of me. And I knew something. If I catch up to that drink, I'll drink it. And I'll die. And knowing I'll die will never keep me from drinking. That's the first step. That's the first step. I'm going to drink again. And knowing I'll drink will never keep me, or I'll die will never keep me from drinking it. Now, when you're sober a little while, the drink gets pushed further and further ahead of you. Pretty soon it's out there a month or 2 months, 3 months, you know, start feeling pretty good. Usually about a year and a half, you stop and say, you know, I need some balance in my life. Yeah. In Alcoholics Anonymous, balance is a euphemism for sex. And you'll begin to seek balance. And what that means, too, is I cut back on meetings. Because, you know, after all, life is more than meetings. And I didn't get sober to spend the rest of my life in those meetings. And besides that, God just sent her along. I mean, you know, all these things sort of come together. It's like a great cosmic exercise. And you go seeking balance. And then after about a month or two of seeking balance and cutting back on meetings, you're in a meeting and you're saying, oh, not her again, God. She always says the same thing. And look at that old fool. And, you know, and pretty soon you've got judgments about everything. And what it means is that you're catching up to the drink. If I catch up to that drink, I'll drink it. Because I'm powerless over that drink. It's got my name on it. That's what it means to me. Now, I've been around your drink and a lot of other drinks. I've dumped drinks out when I do 12-step calls and all that stuff. But if I ever catch up with a drink with my name on it, I'll drink it. Because you see, I'm powerless over alcohol. I'll tell you how powerless I am. I have a lovely daughter, Kimberly, who lives in Alabama. And she just, week before last, had her second daughter, my second granddaughter. And 2 days after, or 2 days before, her sister had my first grandson. So it's been a great month. But Kimberly was born premature. She was weighed less than 2 pounds, and she was very, very sick. And they told me she was going to die. And she was in an intensive neonatal care unit at Georgetown Hospital where I worked. And I won't go into the whole story, but the kid scared me to death. By this time I was pretty sick, and I had gathered that if God found out I loved something, it seemed to be going, and I was afraid he found out I loved her, and I thought he would take her if he knew that. But in utter desperation, Georgetown's a Catholic university, and in utter desperation, in the middle of the night, at 72 hours is a very critical time for these kids, and her mother had gone in and baptized her, and we didn't think she'd live through the night, and I went down to the chapel, and I got in front of the tabernacle, and I begged God as I hadn't understood him, and I hadn't talked to him in a long time, and I begged him to let my little girl live. And I said to him, if you'll let her live, I'll do anything. If you'll let her live, I won't drink. And I was drunk in 12 hours. And I never want to forget that I drank when I thought drinking would cost the life of my daughter. And you know, 2 years later, 2.5 years later, I walk into a room filled with strangers with a very obnoxious old man at the door who looked in my eyes, you know the kind. And then he said to me, oh, you're new, aren't you? And I thought, oh my God, he's psychic, you know. And he's looking in my eyes and he said, you know, son, you keep coming here, you never have to drink again. And I wanted to scream at him, you don't know me. I'm a guy who drinks when he thinks drinking will kill his little girl. There's a great philosopher, a French philosopher and mathematician, Blaise Pascal. And Blaise said that God created man in his own image, and unfortunately man returned the favor. And of course, in my spiritual illness, I had created a God who would kill a little girl because her dad was sick. Of course, that's not the way God operates. But I never want to forget that. That's how powerless I was. And that's what makes the first step the miracle that it is. It's that I didn't pick up another drink. I always picked up another drink. I always did. And on May the 13th, 1973, that stopped. And how can that be? How can that happen? To me, that's every bit as amazing as a law of gravity or something like that. It's just incredible to me that one day I didn't pick up the drink. Now, many, many times I thought I would, many times I thought I'd have to, and all of that. I was not a guy who ever believed that he could make it in Alcoholics Anonymous. But it's, to this day, it astounds me, as Mike was talking, it's a great miracle that I didn't pick up the next drink. And I wondered about the difference between myself on my knees in front of the tabernacle in that chapel at Georgetown University Hospital in 1969. And that same guy who was living in a bedroom, or in a one room in a basement of a house in the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C., who cried out. What's the difference? And our friend Ross would say the difference is the grace of desperation. I was desperate. And, of course, to this day I believe that God was present in a tabernacle. But I didn't believe that anything cared about me or couldn't care about me. And that's what you've taught me. Because of you, I really have come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. And it isn't something I learned in theology class, although I've got a degree in theology. It isn't where I learned it. I learned it from you in that second step. I have a friend, Vicki, who introduced me, and she has a friend, Linda, who couldn't be here today. But I told Vicki the story about that was told to me by my friend Father Bob H. And Father Bob talked about the man in the wheelbarrow. And he said a man strung a wire across Niagara Falls. And he got on the wire and on the buffalo side, and he pushed his wheelbarrow clear across the wire. And by the time he got to the other side, a huge crowd had gathered. And when he had completed the task, they all cheered and applauded and carried on and everything. And he said, do you believe that I can push a wheelbarrow across that wire? And they said, yeah, we believe it. He said, sir, do you believe it? He said, yes, I do. He said, then get in the wheelbarrow. And that's what this program's about. The program's about getting in the wheelbarrow. And that's why this whole business of talk therapy is a waste of time. Now, I have coffee and you don't. That's how you can tell who's important around here. See, Melody? But you know, we really have gotten drifted into this thinking that, what's important is that I talk about my problems and I talk them out, or that I talk about my feelings. And again, this stuff's important. Don't get me wrong. I don't mean to minimize it. That isn't how I get better. Of course, I have to know them and all the rest of it. That's not how I get better. How I get better is by taking action. I remember I wasn't feeling well, and I was supposed to go on a 12-step call. And so my sponsor said, "I'll be over. We're going on a 12-step call." I said, "I don't feel well." He said, "Good, then feel bad going on a 12-step call." It's not important. He said, "If you don't feel better after the 12-step call than you feel before the 12-step call," he said, "I won't make you do it next time." Of course, after the 12-step call, I was on top of the world. Of course I was. So it's not about how I feel. I was pretty newly sober, and I desperately wanted to fit into Alcoholics Anonymous, because I knew if I couldn't fit in here, I was meat. I knew that. And I went to a meeting, and I'd been in a treatment center. Now, this treatment center saved my life. I got nothing bad to say about treatment centers, okay? But coming out of that treatment center, I came out of there with the idea that the way you get well is to share your feelings. And so they're having a discussion meeting. It was a topic of some kind. And I was about the middle of the room, and they went around. They got to me, and I shared my feelings. And as Mike would say, a great hush came over the crowd. And, and then they went on and discussed the topic. And so I came back the next week, and a man met me at the door, and he said, "You're Keith, aren't you?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "You stay sober all week?" I said, "Yes, I did." He said, "How long are you sober?" I said, "6 weeks." He said, "That's great." He said, "You know, we had a business meeting after you left last week." And he said, "The vote was 12 to nothing. Nobody gives a damn how you feel." You know? And he said, "We care what you do." He said, "This is a program of action." He said, "We care what you do." And he said, "Do you feel alone a lot?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Wash ashtrays." He said, "I've never seen a guy who washed ashtrays ever finish and feel alone." I said, "Well, I'll try it." You know. And so I'm washing ashtrays, and he's drying them. And we talked. When we finished, he said, "How do you feel?" I said, "I feel fine. I feel fine." He said, "Do you feel alone?" I said, "No, I don't." He said, "Never fails. Never fails." I don't know what new people do. We don't smoke anymore. But what he was saying was true. You know, if I'm focusing on my feelings, what I'm doing is I'm focusing on self. And you know, when it says now we're at step 3 in the book, page 60, you know, it spends the next 3 pages mentioning self or some derivative of self 23 times. Self, 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 self. That's the problem. Self, 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 self. I remember when I went to Sandy. Sandy B was my sponsor for a number of years. And when I was in Washington, and I went to Sandy, and I was really upset because somebody, some insensitive pig, suggested I was self-centered. It made me crazy. So I went to Sandy. I said, "What's this self-centered crap they're talking about?" And he said, "Well," he said, "Keith," he said, "it's like this." He said, "Supposing we could unscrew the top of your head, you know, and we went into your brain." And he said, "Your brain had a bunch of little index cards in, and every question you'd ever ask would be on one of those index cards." He said, "The question we'd run into most often is, 'Hey, how about me? Anybody know I'm here? Where's mine?'" And I said, "Oh, that's what you mean by self-centered." And it was true. You know, it was true. I was so self-absorbed, so horribly self-absorbed. And the last thing in the world we needed to be talking about was me. And that's why early on, I began to learn that I was responsible for my behavior, that I had to clean it up. Because what was important wasn't how I felt, or what was important is what I did. And I was thinking not long ago, I talked about this out in California last week, and I hadn't thought about it in a while, but when I was new, one of the things, I was so fear-filled and so self-absorbed and so self-centered that I couldn't spend time any place, any length of time, any place. The longest I spent at any single room was an hour in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't go to a grocery store and buy a lot of stuff. I'd have to go every day and buy 10 items and get in that fast checkout line. And one day I'm at the Safeway on Wisconsin Avenue in Georgetown, and I'm in this checkout line. It must have been a slow day, or the guy was bored or something. He counted my stuff. He said, "Sir," he said, "you have 11 items. This is a 10-item line. And I lost it. And I said, what an astute observer you are. That's fantastic. I said, a pig like me trying to sneak through this line with 11 items, and is it just a 10-item line? I said, God, you're good at what you do. And I turned around, and the people behind me, you know, they're standing in a line, and I said to them, you guys ought to be really grateful you got a man like this keeping watch so that a guy like me doesn't sneak through here with 11 items. Now, you know, these people just want to go home, you know, but they don't want to listen to all this stuff. And the guy said, sir, it's all right. It was just a joke. And I said, no, I don't deserve this shop in your store. And the manager came over. And he said, what's the problem here? I said, you ought to be so proud of this man. I said, you need to promote this man. And, you know, he caught me sneaking 11 items through a 10-item one. And I began to weep. And I was crying. I was just out of my mind, you know. And I ran out of there. And I called my sponsor. And his response was always the same. You're where? You did what? Get your ass over here. So I put me in a car. We went back to the Safeway. He said, go. I said, I don't want to go. I can shop someplace else. He said, it's not about where you can shop. He said, it's about what you've done to other people. Get in there. So I went in there, and the manager saw me. He came running up. He said, sir, are you all right? I've had a bad life. Dad never told me he loved me, and mother had a square nipple, and got a bad drinking problem. I'm going to die of alcoholism, and yeah. And I began to learn that what I do, I'm responsible to undo. If I do something wrong, I'm responsible to undo it. But that's really what we teach three-year-olds, isn't it? Pick up your toys. And it'd been years since I picked up my toys. I left everything for others to clean up. And that's why I was insane. That's why wherever I was, it was cluttered. My friend Dick Corcoran, he's been gone for a while. Now, I met a man who knew Dick here. Dick was a retired Marine. And Dick would look at my car and say, what's the matter, Keith? Things aren't... You have trouble? Because my car will become cluttered. And when my car becomes cluttered, I got to do something. Same with my apartment. When I was single and living alone, Dick would look at my apartment and say, well, let's talk. Because that's the way my life was. My life had gotten so cluttered that I couldn't be comfortable. It was cluttered with my behavior. And that's why I was insane. And insanity is just the absence of peace of mind. There was nothing felt good anymore, nothing fit in my life anymore because I had so cluttered things up. And of course, we talk about it in the eighth and ninth step. But I began to understand in the second step that the problem was that I had, to be indelicate, I had crapped where I ate. My lack of maturity, my focus on self, my absorption with me and mine and my happiness and all the rest of it had caused so much damage, collateral damage, that I was never comfortable any place I was. And that's what insanity is. Insanity is a lack of comfort wherever I am. I was a guy, if I stayed in town, I really felt as though I should have left town. If I left town, I felt as though I should have stayed. And that's why page 63 says so much to me. On page 60, it said, being convinced we were step three. That is, we decided to turn our will and life over to God as we understood him. Just what did we mean by that, and just what did we do? And then it goes on for the next couple pages. And it describes precisely the situation I'm in. Okay? The situation I'm in says that we believe that my troubles are basically of our own making. In other words, I'm responsible for me. I'm the guy who got me here. My troubles really weren't the fact that I grew up in poverty, though I did. My Irish grandmother used to say, you know, laddie, it's not a sin to be poor, but it's hellish uncomfortable. And Granny was right. Being poor is hellish uncomfortable. That is not why I was where I was. I had a brother, Dumb Denny, I was with Dumb Denny last week in his home out in Rancho La Quinta, and I was, you know, and a guy said to me one time, I was telling him about how poor I was, and you know, mother had a square nipple, and dad never told me that he loved me, And he said, didn't you have a brother who's an officer with AT&T? I said, yeah, it's Denny. He said, where'd he live?
Well, he's around. Mother always loved him best. He said, well, do you live in the same house as you? I said, well, actually, yeah. He said, was he the brother who slept in the same bed as you? I said, yeah. He said, well, now we've diagnosed the problem, Keith. He said, you slept on the wrong side of the bed. That's your problem. And, you know, and that's the truth, that I began to understand that my brother Denny retired as a vice president, lives in Rancho La Quinta in the desert of California. He retired at age 51 with more money than he can spend. You know why? Because he's responsible for his own life. I end up on 17th and Harvard Street in Washington, D.C. in 1973, financially, spiritually, emotionally, and morally bankrupt. You know why? Because I'm responsible for my life. That's why. The one thing Denny and I have in common is we're both responsible for what happened to us. You know, and I never want to forget that. You know, it wasn't about mother, it wasn't about any of the rest of it. I was responsible. And the problem was self. Selfishness and self-centeredness, we think, is the root of our problems. And if I'm approaching recovery or the rest of these steps with anything else in mind other than the problem is me and it's selfishness and self-centeredness, anything else, if I'm identifying anything outside of me, I'll never have very, very satisfactory results. I will, from time to time, feel good. My goodness, you know, the best I ever felt was when people would gather around me and pat me on the head and tell me how unfair it all was. I never got any better, but I sure felt good because of the attention. Some of you have been around a while. Remember when you were new, how important you were? And all of a sudden they'd say, hi. That was it. What do you mean, hi? That was it. Remember? It's nearly as satisfying. The third step is probably the most critical decision ever made in my life. And it's not one that you make and unmake and all the rest of it. It's a critical decision. It's because I recognize the problem, and the problem is me. And I don't get theological about it or any of the rest of it. I remember going to Sandy one time, and I said to him, well, I'm not exactly sure who I'm going to turn my will and life over to. I've been thinking it over, and, you know, don't care much for organized religion. I was one of those guys who came in, you know, I was religiously anti-religious, and so I don't care much for organized religion. And since then, I've discovered a real problem. The real problem is I wasn't a pope. If I'd have been a pope, I would have loved organized religion. But Sandy was always very succinct with me, and he'd always smile when he said these things, so you couldn't get too angry. But he said to me, he said, Keith, he said, I've been thinking about you, and he said, you're a special case. He said, we're going to turn your will and life over to anything that will take it. He said, you know, a baboon do a better job with your life than you have. And you know, he's absolutely correct. He was absolutely correct. A baboon would have done a better job of my life than I had done. You know, when I asked Sandy, I was sober a couple of years. I was one of these people who really believed that insight was the key. And I don't know, I just thought insight was the key. And I thought if I understood things, I had done them. Or if I talked about them, I had dealt with them. I like that. Are you dealing with that? Yes, I'm dealing with it right now. I'm thinking about it. And I've talked about it to 14 people. And nobody else will talk to me about it. It must mean it's gone. But I was a guy who didn't take to these steps. I just didn't. And I think my first sponsor, his name was Dan. He's a wonderful guy. He saved my life. There's no question. But Dan hadn't done a whole lot. Very active, so we got actively involved, and I went on 12-step calls and went to jails. I did all kinds of things. It really kept me going. And I somehow drifted into the notion that if my life was right, if I had what I thought I needed and I was out of debt and had a good social life, which meant I was seeking balance on a regular basis, if all that happened, then I somehow would be all right. I really thought that it was about building a life. I never suspected it was about building character. And you know, if you work hard, funny things happen. You get stuff. You know, and one day I was off of Skid Row. And I was given a scholarship. I studied in Europe. I spent time in a monastery in Rome. I mean, within a year of my last drink, things happened to me which couldn't happen. And I was in this whirlwind, and I went back to school, and I took a degree in philosophy and theology and published in ethics and published in genetics, and I was on a roll. I'm testifying in front of a House committee on the Hill. I'm just doing all these magnificent things and wasn't doing the steps. I was running on ego. I was running on satisfaction. I was running on attention. And after about 3 years, I started an organization and for some people and did a lot of stuff. And I went to Sandy and said to him, I said, could I talk to you? I'd like to maybe have an hour of your time. I'd like to talk to you. He said, sure. He said, meet me Saturday morning. Bring your running shoes. Well, I didn't have running shoes. I had 4 cartons of cigarettes, but I didn't have running shoes. But I went and bought running shoes, and I put dirt on them so they looked like they'd been used. But I was a genuine article, and I went over to see Sandy, and I'll never forget. We went out running. Now, if you smoke 4 packs of cigarettes a day, and you're running, you get to the point. And the point was I wanted him to sponsor me. And he said, I'd be glad to sponsor you. He said, tell me, do you believe in God? I thought it was a pretty obnoxious question, actually. And I looked at my life, and, you know, it was better than it had ever been, and I was what people called a success by then and everything. But the fact of the matter was I had a lot of doubts. And I grew up, now I wasn't taught this in the schools or the churches or the universities I went to, but I grew up thinking that if you doubt God, it means you don't believe. I'm sure I was never told that. I came away with that thing. I know that's true because one time I said to Dumb Denny, do you ever doubt the existence of God? He said, oh yes. He said, the first half of my first semester in sophomore in college. Only Denny would do it that way. He said, but then I figured out that if there wasn't one, I didn't want to know about it because things were going too well, so I decided there was. Well, I mean, that just makes sense, but I couldn't do it that way. We're running along, and I knew that this was a critical question. I said to Sandy, I said, you know, there's a lot of evidence to the contrary, but I'm afraid I don't believe. And he looked at me, he's really sad. And he said, Keith, I'm afraid that means you're going to have to die. I just stopped. He kept running. Yeah. And I thought for a minute, and I caught up with him. I said, you know, I'm willing to go home and reconsider my position. He said, you know, if you're willing to reconsider your position, you can live. I said, oh, thank you. And he said, if you'll reconsider your position, I'll be your sponsor. And that's how it began for me. It began by reconsidering my position. And I somehow knew on some level that my problem was that I had been wrong. You know, I don't know if this has occurred to you, but if they insist you let go of all of your old ideas, that's the alcoholic's sneaky way of saying you've been wrong. If you've been right, they wouldn't be asking you to let go of all those old ideas. You know? If you're new, that's a shock. But I always like to joke. I see my friend Bill back there, and I like to talk about the old timers, and, you know, Mike and speaker tonight, Ken, and, you know, there are a lot of old timers around this area, and that's too bad, because old timers are not nice people. I'll be honest with you. If you're new, I'd urge you to stay away from them. And I'll tell you why, because they laugh at us. That's what they do, you know. They just laugh at us, and they love our problems. They love to see us have problems, you know. You don't believe it. Hunt Bill up after the meeting and tell him a problem. The first thing he'll do is laugh. They always do, you know. And the only enjoyment they get out of life is watching us suffer. And it's true. And I remember, if you really want to make their day, tell them a problem about sex. You know? They love problems about sex, and they'll always tell you the same thing, don't they? No sex. Isn't that right? They're not having sex anymore. They don't want us to have sex either. So. Let's go to this old timer. And he said to me, I went to him. He's the one I went to. When I got sober, I was impotent. Yeah. But you think it's funny. See, it must be an old timer, right? So I go to this old timer and tell him, you know, you don't just come out with this. You beat around the bush a little bit. And so finally he said, what's the problem? I said, I'm impotent. He said, oh, he said, a lot of us had that trouble when we came in. You'll get over it. I said, when? You know, I thought it was important. He said, what, you got a full social calendar? I went to see him about another problem, and he said to me, Keith, I want you to do me a favor. I said, what's that? He said, I want you to get some lipstick from one of the girls in the program. He said, no, I don't want you doing anything else for the girls in the program. He said, oh, that's right, you can't. So I want you to go home and write on the mirror, Keith, you're wrong. I said, well, I can't do that. You see, my problem is I have a poor self-image and I need to be affirmed. So I never talked that way to an old-timer. They hadn't read any of those books. So I wrote on a mirror, Keith, you were wrong. And I knew they were crazy, you know. And I went to night, I went to sleep. And it was 50 days. Remember 50 days? Oh, it's a normal night, you know. I lay down and closed my eyes. My mind woke up for the first time and took off. And it was, you're never going to make it. They're going to find out you're not an alcoholic. You're really crazy. All this stuff. You see that stuff at Safeway? You think a sane person would do that at Safeway? On and on and on. You're going to be alone the rest of your life. What difference does it make? You're impotent. You're just on and on. Just insane. And 15 minutes before I was supposed to wake up, I go sound asleep. And it would take 3 alarm clocks to wake me up. And I'd be depressed, you know. And I'd go out and I'd say, you know, you're going to go to work today and they're going to fire you. What difference does it make? You're hopelessly in debt. You're just normal stuff, you know. And I just wanted to cry. And I went out and started the coffee. And I went in and I looked on a bathroom mirror and said, Keith, you were wrong. I said, well, thank God. Because if I'm right, I'm in a hell of a lot of trouble. And so, you know, what was I turning over? You know, what was the decision? I mean, what was it that I was jealously guarding? You know, I mean, I'm living in a basement of a house in Skid Row. I'm not allowed in the state of Maryland to see my children. I may or may not have a job. What am I guarding? You know, I mean, what is it that I'm protecting? Me, the essential me. I had no earthly idea what that was. All I know is that you wanted it. And you wanted to change me. You know? And I remember saying to a guy one time, what they want to do is brainwash me. And he said, Keith, they'd have to find it to wash you. And it was true. I mean, you know, if anybody's brain needed washing, it was mine. But somehow I was afraid that I was going to be changed. Then I wouldn't be me anymore. You know? So maybe the next time I stood in front of the judge, he wouldn't recognize me. I mean, why would I want to keep being me? You know, me was dying. I almost took my own life on May the 13th, 1973. Why would I want to continue to be me? Yeah, but. And the book says that my fear is I'll end up being like the hole in a donut. I won't be me anymore. Won't be me. Boy, my ex-wife, everybody had been pleased with that prospect. But somehow I thought I had to protect it, and that's the insanity. That's the insanity. Well, it happened for me. I got on my knees, and I said that third step prayer, and I said it with my sponsor, and I said it aloud. And I've said it with 1,000 people since then, I know. And I remember one guy, real nervous, and I'll never forget it. We were on our knees, and he was just trembling. And I said to him, I said, do you realize at this very moment, there's a man in Africa who's on his knees with his sponsor, and he's going to say this prayer. And he's filled with fear that God's will for him is to become a missionary and come to the United States. How'd you know? You know, and that's our fear, isn't it? Our fear is that God's going to have us do something that we don't want to do, or, in my case, I'm afraid I wasn't competent to do. And I didn't really believe that God didn't make hard terms. And, of course, the book says he doesn't make hard terms, and he doesn't. He doesn't. When I got up from those knees, I wasn't different. But I had made a decision to allow myself to become different. Saying a prayer didn't do it, did it? Saying a prayer just says, I'm going on. That's all it says. It says, I'm going on. I love the way they do it, though. You know, after the prayer. You know, you can't trust these people in Alcoholics Anonymous. After the prayer, what does it say? We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. Now, wait a minute. I already said it was too late. You know, of course, it's the decision. It's the first real action we take, isn't it?
All the rest of it's thinking and considering and weighing the evidence and looking at the arrest record. I mean, it's all right there. That's all it is. It's just saying. I love what a guy used to say to me. He'd say, "Keith, look at your life and ask one simple question." I said, "What's that?" "Would a normal person do that?" And the answer is no. A normal person wouldn't do that. He said, "You're a philosophy major." He said, "How about the prudent man rule? Would a prudent man do that?" "Probably not. You know, a prudent man probably wouldn't get drunk, drink into a blackout, and lead a group of men on a patrol in a combat zone. Prudent man probably wouldn't do that." But it's easy. It's easy to make these decisions. The first action we take, of course, is that one. And then the action starts. People always say, "Well, I don't know if I've taken the third step or not." And, you know, my sponsor made it simple for me. He said, "If one day you walk into your room and you find yourself feverishly writing your fourth step, you've taken the third." He said, "But if you don't get into immediate action like the book says, then you haven't taken that." Now, I was a guy who was going to do a fourth step. I really was. I just had to find the right thing to write it in. And I still have stuff at home that I collected to write that first fourth step in 27 years ago. And if I had to write tablet, I had the wrong writing instrument. I mean, I could just never get them both. But as soon as I got them, you know, I have leather-bound things with little ties on them. I have composition books. I have loose-leaf notebooks. I mean, I collected everything you could write on. I don't have papyrus, so I didn't collect everything you could write on, but I had everything else, you know. And so finally, my sponsor made it easy for me. He said, "Keith, there's a spiritual principle." He said, "This is so true, it's axiomatic." And I said, "You mean in the 10th step?" He said, no. He said, "This is a little-known secret in Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "But I'm going to share it with you. But you have to promise to keep it to yourself." I said, "I promise." He said, "If you get a yellow pad and a number 2 pencil, it's impossible to lie to yourself. So I just pass it on to you, okay?" Now, you know, we heard about, this morning the speaker was talking about, you know, the lists and the outlines and that sort of thing. And I've sure done that. But I'll tell you, I was so confused about the process. I mean, I was really confused. It makes sense to me now because I've done it, but I just couldn't do it. And I think Sandy knew that if I didn't do something, that I was in deep trouble. And so he took a yellow pad and he wrote on it, "Fears." He said, "I want you to list your fears." I said, "I'm not afraid of anything." And he said, "Seems to me one time you told me you were afraid of dogs." I said, "Big dogs. I'm afraid of big dogs." He said, "Write it down." And I wrote down, "Big dogs." And I thought for a minute and I said, "You know, be honest, I'm not wild about little dogs." So I wrote down a little dog. And then it came out, you know, heights. And what I discovered was fascinating to me was that why I felt so crazy, why I was so conflicted, was because all my fears were in conflict with one another. I mean, I was a guy who was afraid of being alone, and I was afraid of intimacy, which explained why I jumped in and out of relationships all the time, and why the women in my life would finally say to me, "For God's sake, what do you want?" Because I was constantly saying, "Come close, stay away, come close, stay away. I want to be with the rest of my life. I don't like you. I feel as though we should part for a while." You know, all that insanity, you know. And I never understood why. I never understood why. I was also a guy who was was afraid of failure, horribly afraid of failure, which is pretty normal. But if you're also afraid of success, it puts a real crimp in your climb up the corporate ladder. Because what I would do is I'd work very, very hard. I love to work, and I love to work hard. I like to accomplish. And then you'd start going up the ladder, and then the fear of success would take over. You know, because if you're successful, you know what they'll do? They'll expect more from you next year. And so what I would do is I would run off and take another job. And I began to understand how the conflicting fears jerked me around my whole life. I was a guy who was, I grew up in poverty, and my parents never said this to me, and I mean that. My parents never said this, no one ever said this to me. But I somehow came away with a notion that if I had material things, you're bad. If And I think this is how we explain our poverty to ourselves. It was, if you accumulate material things, you're bad. All those people are bad. And now, again, I was never told this, but this is what I came away with. And so it explained to me why, whenever I began to accumulate anything, I would do something stupid, like make a bad investment, or buy something I didn't need, or do something to blow it. And I never understood it. I remember the first car I bought sober. I drove my alcoholic car up to Ohio, and it wouldn't come back. I mean, it wasn't coming back. There was no question about it. And I called Dan, my sponsor, and I said, "Dan, I got to get rid of my car." He said, "Thank God." And I said there were a couple of them here. I said they cost about the same. I said they're both a couple of years old and they cost about the same. He said, "Well, tell me about them." And I said, "Well, one of them is really practical." He said, "Keith, if you come home with a practical car, I'm going to break your knee." Because he knew me. You know, he knew me. He knew that the minute I bought anything, I would regret buying it. And it was just that sort of craziness that comes with growing up in poverty, blaming others. When we were kids, my father worked in a factory, and the man who owned that factory loved my father. He was a wonderful machinist and a hard worker, and he missed 8 days of work in almost 40 years. And my mother didn't have enough sense to have the children at night, so he was there for the births of 8 of his children, and that's why he missed work. And that was it. I mean, that's how that guy worked. And he always knew he was going to get fired if he wasn't there. And he was employed. He was foreman of the month for 36 consecutive months. And one day he overslept and he knew they'd fire him. And that sort of fear. And I remember him saying to us one time, he said, "We're going to go out to the boss's house for Christmas." He'd have us out for Christmas. You know, my father had a bunch of children and he liked my father and he was trying to be nice. And my dad would say, "For God's sake, don't touch anything. He has lamps that cost as much as our whole house." I remember I'd sit out there and he'd say, "Would you like to play marbles?" "No, sir." Sitting on his sofa, and I looked up at that lamp and I say to myself, "Keith, don't touch it. If you break that lamp, they're going to take our house." And I mean, all this craziness, just craziness that comes with that fear. And that's the first thing that I had to do, was I had to list fears. And then, and the book says that the fabric of my being is shot through with fears. And then the next thing he wrote was anger, and he put down resentments. What are the things, the people, the places, the things that you resent and you're angry with? And boy, I had a great relationship with the fear. And then he wrote sex. And he said, "I don't know how to tell you to do this." He said, "Write down everything that bothers you." He said, "There are no rules." He said, "You write down what bothers you." And you know, it was crazy stuff. And you know, it's funny now, but it wasn't funny then. One of my great secrets was the fact that when I was 3 years old, I had an older sister. She was 5. Worst thing you can have, worse than alcoholism, is an older sister. And she put a dress on me. And I knew I was probably a transvestite. And I wrote it down. And crazy stuff. I mean, stuff, of course, that made no difference. My mother had a torn dress, and one time a guy commented that he saw her breast or something, and I was angry and mortified. Now, this is all crazy stuff. I was 6 years old or 7 years old. But it was all there. He said, "Write it down. Anything has anything to do with stuff like that, just write it all down." And I did. And then he took me into the 12 and 12, and he told me, he said, "Write down the questions, write down the answer. How and in what way did my selfish pursuit of the sex relation damage others? Who was hurt and how?" And I began that thorough writing and answering. And later I went back and did two other ways. I did it the way it says in the big book. Somebody said to me, "If you don't do it the way it says in the big book, you'll get drunk." I said, "Well, I must have forgotten that, because I hadn't gotten drunk." But now, ultimately, I did go back and do it that way, just so I could say I'm a real member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But you know, I don't want to trip over things, and I sure don't have any negative thoughts about anybody does any of this stuff. What matters is that I get it done, and that I not drink. That's what matters. And I ultimately did that. And I did one other thing, which I found to be very, very useful in my particular case. Okay, my sponsor had me take the 7 deadly sins one at a time. They're in the 12 and 12. Okay, in the fourth step. And he said, start with pride. He said, because that's the one you have the least trouble with. And he said, I want you to find a good definition of pride. And then I want you to watch yourself on a day-to-day basis to see how pride enters into your life. I said, well, that'll be easy because I've overcome all of this. And he said, you can start with that. And I didn't. I carried a little notebook. And some of the guys I sponsor, I have is, I carry a little notebook. And I see myself. I mean, it's there. It's there all the time. And I'm different. I'm special. And I should have special treatment. I mean, I go into a bank. They want me to get in line with the rest of the people, you know. And the damn stoplight is waiting for me to come to stop me. And I'm always, you know, on and on. I stop at the barbershop. There are three people in front of me, you know. I say, how many people are there in front of me? And the barber says, one, two, three. That means you're fourth. That isn't right. That shouldn't be. I should be next. I mean, that's just the way it is. I should be next. And I'm not proud of that. But that's just the truth. And that's how my mind works on the inside. And I always say, well, thank you. I'll be glad to wait. On the inside, I'm saying, what are these cretins doing ahead of me? And so I took each of the seven deadly sins a week at a time. And I wrote down. And I saw how those things were involved in my life. And I mean, involved in my life to this day. To this day. It's subtle and it's sneaky. But it's always there. Self is always trying to reexert itself. You know, I said to a man, it was down in New Orleans, just before the International down there in 1980, a man named John Powell. I was down there, and I stayed at Loyola University, and on one side of me was John Powell, the Jesuit psychologist and priest, good guy, and not a member of AA, but loves AA. And the other side was John the Indian. And so I hung out with these two guys for a couple of weeks. It was wonderful. And I remember I was sober about 7-8 years, and it was a very difficult time for me, 6-8 years, very difficult time. And I think it is for a lot of people. It's when you start making decisions about being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said to John, I was just fed up with his spiritual crap. And I said to him, I said, what's this all about? I said, what's this spiritual life really all about? And he said, it's very simple, Keith. He said, Alcoholics Anonymous is a perfect place for this to happen. He said, the first thing we do is we discover who we are. And I might add to that who we aren't. Okay? My friend Bob B. used to say, I'm not the man I used to be and I never was. And so I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with a lot of fantasies of who I was. And I wasn't that person. But he said, the first thing we do is we discover who we are. He said, the second thing we do, which is much more difficult, is we fully accept who we are. He said, then we're able to forget who we are. He said, the spiritual person rarely thinks of themselves. Of course, if we go to page 86 in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the questions that we ask ourselves at night is, have I spent most of the day thinking about myself? So that's the goal. The goal is to discover who I am, to fully accept who I am, and then to forget who I am. And a truly, truly peaceful people have forgotten who they are. I don't mean to be judgmental, and I don't mean this way at all, but all my life, I wondered what it was about religious people that turned me off. You know, the people who wanted me to change and wanted to convert and all the rest of it. Why was I turned off by them? And I loved old-timers and Alcoholics Anonymous. Who wanted me to change, wanted me to be different, wanted me to believe what they believe. Exactly the same thing. Okay? And I think I know the difference. The difference is that the old timers knew who they were. They fully accepted who they were and they'd forgotten who they were. If you play at being religious, it's like playing at being funny. It's like playing at being humble. It's like playing at being anything. People look at you and say, it's not true. It rings false. It rings false. And that's what always turned me off about people who had come to my door, well-meaning people, many of whom loved me, who said, you know, you got to believe this, you got to do this, you got to do this, you got to do that. And often wondered why I was repulsed by it. And I was repulsed by it because they hadn't forgotten who they were, and what I was dealing with was self in them. Not the ideas, but the person. Members of Alcoholics Anonymous presented exactly the same ideas to me. And they were not only palatable, they were desirable. So that's the fourth. That's how I wrote the fourth step, the different ways that I did the fourth step. And then I did the fifth. Why don't we take a break and I'll launch into the next one. The fifth step. Admitted God to ourselves and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. I was talking to someone from Chicago today, and we were discussing this. And you know, by the time I did the fifth step, Sandy was my sponsor, and he said to me, "I'd like you to take the fifth step with someone else." And I just assumed that I'd be taking it with him, and I was a little hurt, and asked him why, and he said, "I'll tell you later." And so I thought about who I'd take it with, and I ended up taking it with a man named Ed. And Ed was also from the class of 64 and just a wonderful man. And I took it with Ed, and later I found out that Sandy's concern, I'd always been looking for heroes, and Sandy was a hero, and his concern was that I wouldn't be as honest with him as I might somebody else, because I really wanted him to like me. And there may have been something to that. Of course, I ended up telling him everything that was on there, but what Ed had me do was a little bit different, and I'm awfully glad he did it this way. And I've done it this way myself on some occasions. And Ed told me, he said, "I want you to do exactly what's in the fifth step." And I said, "Of course." He said, "No, no." He said, "Exactly." He said, "I want you to go admit to God, to yourself, and to another human being the exact nature of your wrongs." And I said, "What are you getting at?" He said, "Is there a place that you experience God?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I guess so." And he said, "I want you to go there." And he said, "Talk to God about this." And I said, "Well, I don't know if I want to do that." I said, "You know, God was there when I did it, and he was there when I wrote it, and he'll be there when I tell you. And if he wants to listen, that's his business." He said, no. And you know, I put on a suit, and I went to that same chapel that I begged for my little girl's life. And I went in and I sat down all alone and just talked to God. And I'm so glad I did that. And I'll tell you why. Because my whole life was spent talking around God. I know that I took a degree in theology to learn about God. I did everything I could to avoid dealing with God. And that's why I was so afraid of him. And I sat down and said, "To the best of my ability, this is who I am and what I've done." And I just told him. And then I went home and I sat in front of a full-length mirror, still with my suit on, and I took it with myself. And you know, when I was finished, and this is no exaggeration, I would have told a bus driver. I always thought I was afraid of other people. I wasn't. I was afraid of God and I was afraid of me. And once it was all out in the open, it was no big deal at all. And I ran down to the beach, and Ed C. was down at the beach. And I didn't realize till later that he was seeking balance down there. I didn't know that. And I saw him, and I said, I got to tell you now. And I drove. He said, "Well, maybe tomorrow morning." No, it's got to be now. It's got to be now. You know, and what a great member of Alcoholics Anonymous was. Instead of seeking balance, he listened to me. Boy, I'm hot. Might be menopause, huh? It's okay. No wonder I took my jacket off.